Our speaker this morning comes to us from Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I saw him a couple of days ago, and I told him we needed to get together and really get to know each other. But I've been so busy doing what I do best, I just haven't had time, you know, to sit down and really get to know him. I did talk with him a few minutes ago, and he tells me that they're tearing down a lot of my old watering holes in Fayetteville. I was up there in the summer of 1957, and I was getting ready for this program, and he was telling me about the joints and where the prostitutes was. I said, well, they might have been some of them too when I was there, but I was so busy drinking I didn't have time, you know, to check them out. It's real funny, you know, when we're drinking and all this thing, these folks accuse us of a lot of this stuff, and a good drunk just can't do two things and do them both well, and I just, you know, I always like to be the best at what I was doing. So I never did mix business with pleasure, and drinking was a real serious business with me. I was good at it. I practiced long and hard, and it took every bit that I drank to get me to this fellowship, and I'm sure that I'm not any different from our speaker this morning. And I, even though I have never talked to him, I know him, you know, like a book, because his story, I'm sure, is he can tell it better than mine, but it's pretty much like mine. But if y'all will, help me welcome Keith L. from Fayetteville.
Thank you very much. My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to announce, if anybody has misplaced a code, I found it, and I'd be very happy to give it back. But my voice holds out, and if you'll bear with me, we'll get through this 1 minute at a time, or one sentence at a time. I want to thank the committee for inviting me here. It's always a privilege to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege that's beyond description for me. I think it sort of says what you and God have done for me better than anything else, and that is that you would sit for a little while and listen to what I have to say. So I want to thank you very much. And I want to thank the other speakers for giving me so very much. I've sat and listened intently and hung on to every word that you fed me, and I really appreciate it. I love each and every one of you for your sharing. I also want to thank everybody else who's been here. It's sort of a mixed blessing to speak last at these things. On the one hand, you can remain anonymous, which is real nice. The other hand is that I hear all these wonderful things said, and I always say, geez, I wish I'd have thought of that. But, you know, it's always been like that with me, because I've never, ever believed that I had anything to bring any place. And so I spent my whole life trying to figure out how I could borrow things from other people, so I would be acceptable. My sponsor spoke here a few years ago. His name's Sandy B. And Sandy said it better for me, I think, than anybody I ever heard say. He said, I was such a stranger in the world that he said I could be standing on a corner in a strange town, and someone would come up to me and say, excuse me, you're standing in my spot. And he said, I'd move. And that's how I feel. I always felt that way from the time I was a little kid. My problem was that I thought you felt that way too. And I know most of you did, but most of the people out there didn't. You know, when you're little kids, remember how you always used to have the arguments as soon as you got past whose daddy could beat up whose daddy? The next argument was, this is my property. You know, a kid could be on my front porch and he'd say, this is my property, and I'd leave. I just never belonged where I was. And I don't understand that. And you know, the first time I felt that I belonged was shortly after my last drink, and that took place on May the 13th, 1973, through the grace of God and through people like you. I was 29 years old and I was completely spent. There's absolutely nothing else left. When I came here, the old timers used to say things to me that would keep bringing me back. You heard about Dick's fantastic machines. Dick gave me my tape last night. I I played it last night, and it was blank. He said it was my humility talk. But when I say I was spent, I mean that I played every card I had. I tried every idea I could come up with. I put every manipulative ploy that I could begin to imagine or fantasize. And my life ended up in a small dive of an apartment on Harvard Street in Washington, D.C. And I tried to commit suicide at 29 years of age. And I really didn't start life to commit suicide. I was born and raised in that hotbed of alcoholism, a good Christian home. And I had 10 brothers and sisters. So I went to the same church that Bob and Juanita went to. We don't have rhythm. I was extremely wealthy. I remember that. The thing, I didn't realize that for a long, long time, but when I was a little kid, I was extremely wealthy. Now, I want to tell you, we had a real cash flow problem. My father worked in a mill, and he raised, as a machinist, and then later as a foreman, and he raised 11 of his own children and a good number of the neighborhood children who were drawn to that incredible phenomenon in our house called love and caring and interest. But I got spiritually ill very, very early, and I'm going to talk a little about the seeds of my illness and then later about how that sort of manifested itself in my particular case of alcoholism. If you're new here, for God's sake, don't judge your alcoholism by mine. And please don't judge your chances of recovery by mine, because we're all different. God loves us all as much as He can, and we all get better our own way. But, I grew up in a house where every day that I can remember, my mother put her arms around me and kissed me and told me that she loved me. Every day that I can remember, my father would spend the evening with us. Now, later, when I was a teenager, he began working evenings. But prior to that time, every day he'd come home from the mill, and his shoes would actually be making noise from the grease and everything that was in them. And he'd wash up, and we'd eat, and we'd go to the ball field, down to the old mill field, and play baseball. Every day. He taught us to bunt. He taught us how to hit a knuckleball. He taught us how to catch pop flies behind us, so we learned hand and eye coordination. And then in Ohio, when it got too cold to go to the mill field to play baseball, we went down in the basement, and I fielded grounders off the back wall, and my father, being a machinist, invented a number of things they now use in the major leagues called batting tees. He invented batting tees. He invented a machine where the ball slid on a wire so that you could check your timing. We'd go to spring training almost burned out. We worked all winter at it. Every day that I was ever home, when I came home from the Marine Corps and even staggering in drunk and passing out, my father did a peculiar thing. He would knock on the door, and I'd say, "Come in," and he'd stick his head in the door, and he'd say, "Do you have enough blankets?" And I don't care if it was August. He would say, "Do you have enough blankets?" And I'd say, "Yes, Dad." And he said, "Did you say your prayers?" And I said, "Yes, Dad." And he said, "Good night." And when I was 29 years old, and I lived in that dive on Harvard Street in Washington, D.C., I would have sworn to you that I was there because my parents never told me they loved me. And I'm convinced that that's what my dilemma is. And I thank God for the booze. I like to read the Big, Big Book, and in the Big, Big Book, I frequently hear that phrase, "eyes to see and ears to hear." And I was completely surrounded by love for as long as I could remember. I had parents and brothers and sisters and teachers and coaches and clergymen in my life who loved me, loved me, loved me. They loved me not verbally, although that happened too. They loved me in every action and every thought and every deed. They loved me intensely. And I couldn't see it and I couldn't hear it. All I ever saw or all I ever heard were things that reminded me that I was inferior. I was terrified. Even as a child, I was terrified. I was afraid because I didn't know what I was supposed to be afraid of. And I was afraid to ask. And I remember that. We didn't have television and things when I... Well, it was invented. I'm not that bad. But we didn't have one. And so we'd go to bed fairly early. We'd pray together usually every day. And we had a reading hour. And then we had democracy where we would vote on what we were going to do with the family resources. And then my father had veto power. And then we'd beat it off to bed, and my brothers and sisters would go right to sleep. And I just lay there, practicing terror, till well into the morning. To this day, I sometimes just lay awake at night. I don't have to practice terror anymore, because I'm no longer desperately alone. But I used to lay there and just practice terror. And I got real good at it. I had something lived under my bed. I don't know if you had anything lived under your bed. But I just lay there, and it would start to move around when the lights were out. And it must have been awful, because nobody who ever saw it ever lived to tell. Because I used to listen to a lot of conversations, and nobody ever brought the thing up. And I figured anybody who saw it died. So I wasn't going to look. And I'd get in bed at night, and I was always a little skinny kid. I used to say I used to be tall and I'd been sick, but that's a lie. I'd never been tall. And I used to lay in bed, and I was a real skinny kid. And I'd lay there at night, and I'd hear that thing moving around. And some nights it'd sound hungry. And it used to reach up on both sides of the bed and try to get me. And in the morning, if you'd wake up and look at the sheets, it had those marks in it where its claws were trying to get me. And so I'd spend a lot of nights laying in the middle of the bed, just concentrating on being real skinny. And in the daytime, it's lived in a closet. So I used to get my clothes out at night and try to get in bed before it got dark. It was a strange way to live. And then I just lay there. I also had an idea that you all knew what the hell was going on, and I was the only one who didn't. It was sort of like God got everybody into a big room like this. And he said, "Now I want you to pay attention. I want to go through it one time." And he explained about the world. He explained about growing up. Explained about being a real man. Tattoos. Explained about women. Explained about all those things. And I was in the bathroom. And everybody else knew what was going on. And I was the only one who didn't. And it wasn't, and this is the truth, it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized you didn't know what the hell was going on either. But very early on, my job was to begin to act like I knew what was going on. Somebody would say to me, "You know about girls?" I'd say, "Of course I know about girls." And inside I was saying, "I wonder what they mean about girls. Do you know about growing up?" "Of course I know about growing up." And inside I was saying, "You don't know anything about growing up. What are you lying to those people for? You're never going to grow up. You're never going to make it." And that was my theme song. You're never going to make it. And I sort of slid through life like this. It's a horrible existence. The big hole in the middle of you that I've heard people talk about, that the wind blows through. Sort of sadness and depression and living on the edge of an abyss. It's the way I live. And the horror of that was that I was surrounded by this incredible love. Incredible love. If any of you are in Al-Anon and think you didn't love enough, that's not the case. Please don't think that way. That's not the case. No one could have been loved more than I was loved. Especially by God. And I couldn't see or hear that either. And the sadness is that I learned to reject the people who love me the most in the greatest ways. Geez, you want to scare me? Love me. You want to scare me? Don't criticize me. Accept me just exactly the way I am. And I'll know your judgment stinks. My whole existence was based on old ideas. And I'll tell you some of my old ideas. One old idea I had was there was only so much love in the world. And if you got some of it, I got less. And that's why when I had two beautiful little daughters and people around them tried to love them, I was jealous. If my little girls loved other people, I was jealous because I thought that if they loved them 10%, So it was only 90% for me to get my share. I also had the idea that a little jealousy proves there's love there. And what I know sober is that jealousy proves that there's nobody there. There's nobody here. And when I begin to experience jealousy, it's because I'm beginning to experience the old idea that I'm not worth anything. And if you had a choice between me and somebody else, you'd pick somebody else. We don't know why that is with me. It just is. It's a soul sickness that they talk about in the big book. You know, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you I had my first drink on July the 14th, 1961, the day I joined the Marine Corps, which all skinny little kids who have things hiding under their beds do. But that isn't true, because I had a drink when I was a little kid, and I want to tell you about that drink, because it was significant. This Thursday, my brother Denny's coming to visit me. Some of you heard about Denny already, and I'm going to give him a tape one of these days, probably just before we play a round of golf. But I want to tell you about Denny. Denny's a year younger than I am. He looks much older, but he's a year younger. And he and my father and I were sitting around the kitchen table where everything took place in our home. And my mother was out either, I don't know, having a baby or a bingo or something. And my father rarely had alcohol around the house because they had experience with alcoholism. So they rarely had alcohol around the house. And they came, my father had a few beers in the refrigerator, which was odd. But he took them out, and I can understand this being a father. He took out three beers, and he gave one to me, one to my brother Denny, and he had one. And he gave us little jelly glasses. And my little jelly glass, remember they had cartoon characters on it. And my little jelly glass had Superman on it. Now, in my studies in psychology, I can make a hell of a lot out of that, but I don't. But I began to drink this beer, and it was fine, but I looked after about 20 minutes, I looked over at Denny, and Denny's sliding down out of the chair. And my father panicked, and he jumped up, and he said, "I want you to put your pajamas on and go right to bed. Don't say anything to your mother." And I'm a nice kid. I was always trying to get along with everybody, because if they found out, they'd send me away. So I was working real hard, and I said, "Okay, Dad." And I went and I put on my jammies, you know, the kind with the feet and the trap door and everything. And I was ready to go to bed. Denny wasn't having it. He's rolling around under the kitchen table singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and giggling. And my father put him in his jammies and took us upstairs and put us in bed. And he said, "Go right to sleep. Don't say anything to your mother, and I'll take you to the movies." Well, that was more than a kid like me deserved already. I mean, just being allowed to stay there and eat and things was more than I deserved. And movies was beyond my wildest expectations. And so I was laying there concentrating on not being afraid, not going to sleep. And my brother Denny was giggling and laughing and everything. And then finally Denny stood up in bed and he urinated all over the floor. Never forget it as long as I lived. And I was on the other side of the room, fortunately, and I was watching this. And he's giggling and everything. And I remember, I don't remember the exact words, but they went something like, I was thinking, you know, now there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And the saddest thing in the world happened. My brother grew up to become a social drinker. Just enough to break your heart. He had more potential than anybody I ever saw in my life. And he just grew up to be a social drinker. It's awful. I don't talk much about him because as a family we're kind of embarrassed. But I want to tell you a few things he did. He grew up, he finished high school, and he went to one college. And it gets worse. He had one major. He finished in 4 years. He went to one graduate school. He got out. He surveyed a number of companies. He picked one company. He's been with them ever since. And the most disgusting thing of all, 15 years ago, he married one woman. You know, he had it. Had the whole world in the palm of his hands. He let it slip through his fingers. It's enough to make you cry. I meet him from time to time, and we'll have dinner or something. And the waiter will come and ask if we want a drink, and he cringes when the waiter says, "Do you want a drink?" He just doesn't know what's going to come out of me. And I say something like, "Give me a case of scotch with a fire axe." And he says disgusting things like, "No, thank you, not on an empty stomach." I screamed at him one time, "Have a few drinks and your stomach won't be empty anymore." And I guess every family has black sheep, but he's one of them. He's really a wonderful, delightful human being, and I just love him a lot. And we were real close as little kids, because as little kids, we had spiritual values. And I'm a firm believer that spiritual values are the things that knit us together, that moral and spiritual values are the things that hold us together as human beings and as a fellowship and as family and as friends. But my spiritual values began to erode after I began to drink. And so I became unknit. I became a person who drifted free of anything and didn't belong anywhere or with anyone and didn't deserve to belong. Some philosophers call it the existential vacuum or something. I don't know what it was. All I know is that no place that I was did I belong. And I went every place. I went every place looking. I went in and out of relationships. I went in and out of countries. I went every place looking. And I began to acquire and things, and I looked for it in things, and I began to accomplish, and I looked for it in accomplishments. I remember the first night I drank, and then I want to talk about recovery, but first night I drank was the Unlimited, was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was the day that I joined the Marine Corps. And I want to tell you what went to the Marine Corps. I weighed 113 pounds, I was 5 feet 1 inches tall, and I was terrified. And I was sworn in to the Corps, and I was, there were three other guys, and they said to me, "We have to catch a train at midnight. Why don't we go and have a few drinks before then?" And it was about 4 o'clock. And I knew I could never survive for 8 hours in Pittsburgh by myself, so I went along, because I'd probably miss a train. I mean, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And I went along, and I went into this bar, and I can't describe to you what I felt like. I went into this bar. This bar was filled, just filled with real men. You know, they worked in steel mills and coal mines. They had tattoos. They cussed. They said words I couldn't even figure out. And I mean, they were real men. And every one of them had one real woman with them. Real women are women who hang around with real men. And guys like me gets what's left, see. And I figured I'd just sit there and try to be anonymous. And a man came by, and I was listening to him, and they knew all the things that were going on. They knew all about the world and stuff. And I was listening to him, and I said, "Geez, well, I wish I could learn about the world." But, you know, I was in the bathroom when this was all explained. So they brought me a beer. And the only reason I had a beer is because everybody else did. That's why I had a beer. And I remember a psychologist went crazy trying to figure out why I drank in the first place. I drank in the first place because I was 5 feet 1 inch tall, 17 years old, weighed 113 pounds. I was in a bar filled with real men and real women, and I did not have the guts to ask for sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. Magic is what happened after I drank in the first place, because they brought me another one, and I had it because everybody else did. And then they brought me another one, and I want to tell you what happened. I mean, somewhere between that second and third beer, I stood up, and I was shocked. Because the floor was way down there. And I looked over and my left shoulder was way out there. And my right shoulder was way out here. And my muscles were just rippling and tearing at the fabric in my shirt. I couldn't believe it. But that was the small, insignificant aspects. What was important was I looked around this nice nightclub I was in. And it was filled with these snibbling, needy, insignificant little creatures with tattoos, foul mouths. And they all had a woman with them who were looking at me, and I could read their eyes. And I knew what they were saying. They were saying, 1 hour with him. 1 hour, that's all I want. Just 1 hour. And I remember how sad I was that there wasn't enough of me to go around. And my time in Pittsburgh was short, so I went around from table to table, and I began to explain to them about the world and what it was like to be a Roman man. I told them about the Marine Corps, I told them about women and everything. And they were saying, oh, thank you, have another beer, stay a little bit longer. And I said, no, I have to move on, there are other people here I have to talk to. And I remember I bid them a fond farewell, and I went and got on the train, and the next morning I woke up in Washington, D.C. That was three times as far as I'd ever been from home in my life. And I was terrified. I was this insignificant little 5'1", 113-pound loser standing in the middle of Union Station in Washington, D.C., not knowing what the hell was going on. And somebody said to me, let's go over to the Monaco and have a beer. And I didn't know where else to go because I'd probably get lost standing there, so I went. And somewhere between the second and third beer, it happened again. And that's when I discovered that, indeed, there was a power greater than I was that could alter my reality, that could make the world a place in which I not only belonged, but I excelled. What a magnificent feeling for someone who had never belonged. And do you know that when I'd get somewhere between the second and third beer, perfect strangers could emit enough love for me to grow on, enough love for me to feel at home in. That was the magnificence of alcoholism. I don't believe I would have survived this world were it not for my ism. I mean that sincerely. I really do. But I also know that 12 years later, I would not have survived another hour without finding you. Because I did all the things you do, you know. I finished the Marine Corps, and I did well. I got Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award, and the American Spirit of Honor Medal, and I got all these meritorious promotions. And I had one goal in mind, which was to get a commission, because a commission's something for a poor little kid from the steel and coal fields of Ohio. And I worked hard, and I got that commission, and then I got out of the service instead of taking it, because I realized that the Marine Corps was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I went to work in a steel mill, and I began to study metallurgy. My brother Scott is a chemical engineer, and I really admire him a lot, and I wanted to work with him, so I started to take metallurgy. But, you know, working in a steel mill is an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny, so I went to Baltimore and went to work in a research laboratory, in a genetics laboratory, and began to attend the university, and that was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I went to Washington and went to work at Georgetown University Hospital, and that's an abnormal way to live. Their basketball team wasn't winning then, and it made me drink funny. So I figured out what the problem was. My problem was I was single. So I got married, and you talk about an abnormal way to live. And it made me drink real funny. So the two of us began to get real sick together real fast. My story is quick. It's real quick. And, you know, within a few years, we had two beautiful daughters. And I was just as sick as I could be. And my wife and I were into starting over. I don't know if any of you ever started over, but starting over was fun. I think I learned to do it in high school. I used to pick a fight with my girlfriend in high school so we could make up. Because I think that when we're apologizing to one another, it was the only time I felt equal. I felt equally sorry. And it was the only equality I ever experienced in my life, I think, as I look back. But anyway, we'd make up. And the way you make up is you take the children to grandmother's house. So we'd take the children to grandmother's house. And then we'd go back and we'd make up. And what would happen was I'd promise to come right home from work, which is a long way. Hours sometimes. Days sometimes. But I'd promise to come right home from work. And for her part of the agreement, she'd go out and buy these frilly little things that did funny things to me when she wore them. And so I'd come straight home from work and we'd have dinner and we'd dance or we'd go to the theater or something, and we'd come home and she'd put on one of these frilly little things that did funny things to me, and we'd make love, and the next morning I'd get up and have breakfast in bed, and we'd talk, and I'd be off to work, and I'd do this for a day, maybe two. Then I realized that I was being selfish, because the guys at the bar were wondering how this starting over was going, so So I'd run by to tell them how it was going, you know how time flies in a bar, and I looked up, and I, it was 9 or 10 o'clock, and I knew what was going to happen. I'd get home, and she always left that stuff she cooked laying there until the maggots took over. She'd clean up everybody else's, and she'd leave mine laying there. And I didn't want to go home and look at that, and I knew she'd complain and everything. And so I figured, well, you know, let her go to sleep and then go home. You're doing this for her. So I let her go to sleep. I get home about 2:30, and I come in. You know, on the way home, I was thinking, you know, you're awfully selfish. You know, this woman is so mad about you. She goes out and buys these things just to turn you on. And, you know, you owe it to her. You owe it to her to make love. So I went home and woke her up and told her we were going to make love. Well, what happened was she used to put on this outfit. I used to call the Al-Anon outfit. Started way up here. And it went down to here, you know. It went clear to the floor, and it was real thick. It looked like sort of like canvas or something. And it was brown, and it looked like a buffalo robe. And she put this on, and what it meant in the vernacular was not tonight, buddy. And you know, and I know my rights. And who's wearing a pants in this family anyway? And, you know, I don't want to come home to somebody in a buffalo robe. And I began to demand my rights. And to keep from doing anything to her, I used to tear the apartment up. And I'd turn over furniture, and I'd scream, and I'd throw trash all over the place and everything. And she'd get frightened because she thought I was serious. And she'd grab her purse and her matching buffalo house coat. And out the door she'd go, you know. And I knew what she was going to do. She was going to go call the psychiatrist she was seeing, which explained why I drank. And he was going to tell her to call the police because he'd never heard my side of the story. And he's probably in love with her anyway. So I know about police. I wasn't born yesterday. So I ran around and I vacuumed that place. And I picked up all the trash and I straightened up all the furniture and everything. I got it looking real good. And I ran in the bedroom and I took off my clothes. And I had pajamas I wore when the police came. And I put my pajamas on. And I brushed my teeth and gargled and messed my hair up. And the doorbell rang. And I went out and I looked through the peephole. And there was my wife standing there in her buffalo robe, just sort of trembling and crying. And there were a couple of policemen there with her, and one guy's about my age, about 24 or something like that, and the other guy's an old guy, about 30, and I pulled the door open, and I said, "Thank God you found her," sir, could we come in? I said, "I'm sorry, I'm beside myself with worry," and they came in, and they looked around, the place looked good, you know. And my wife got that, Al-Anon look, you know, and just looked down at the floor. And you know, with the police, you can't be too safe. So I said to her, "Sweetheart, did you call the doctor?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, thank God, if you have to run out of here in the middle of the night, at least you called the doctor." And she began to cry, and she ran in the bedroom. And remember, the older policeman sort of reached over and hit me on the arm, and he said, "You hang in there, son." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he left, you know, and I went in and I got a big glass and I put an ice cube in it so I wouldn't be an alcoholic and I filled it up with scotch and then I got her a glass of wine and I took it in and she was sitting on the side of the bed and I asked my higher power, whom I call God, to never let me forget this. She was sitting on the side of the bed and she was crying huge tears and I believe that the deeper a person's hurt, the bigger their tears are. And she cried these huge tears, and they just dripping off her cheek on her buffalo robe. And I gave her the glass of wine, and she looked up at me and said, "Can you ever forgive me for embarrassing you like that?" And I told her, I said, "Honey, you're just having a hard time. You can't help it." And she said, "Don't ever abandon me." And I said, "I'll never do that." I said, "I love you. We'll get through this." You know, she took the buffalo robe off and she put on one of those frilly things that did funny things to me. And you know, we lay in one another's arms that night and we believed we were normal. We believed we were the lucky ones. And that's how sick we were. And that's sad. And, you know, that can't long last. And she said to me one day, you just have to leave. I don't mind you killing me, but I have to think of the kids. And I knew she was right, and I was relieved, and I left. And then I was allowed for the next 6 months to go to where I had to go to. I still had a job, but I didn't show up much. And I drank around the clock a lot, which I had never done up until this time. And I woke up one morning in this place in Washington, D.C., very near Skid Row, and just didn't want to live anymore. I'd been drinking in bootleg joints on 14th Street in Washington. I ain't the right color to drink in bootleg joints on 14th Street in Washington, especially with my mouth. And one guy at the time, a big black man, picked me up and put a 45 in my mouth. I actually gagged on it. And he said, I'd kill you, you fat honky, but I don't want to do you no favors. And I realized that that's what I wanted. What I wanted was for someone to do it for me. And I went home and I thought about that and thought about that, and I literally saw no way out but dying. I was 29 years old and I saw no way but death. And I think I began to take these pills. I'm not sure. I had a lot of pills. I worked in hospitals and people noticed my nervous condition and they used to hand me all these pills. And by the grace of God, I never took them. But I was so moved by Bob's talking about Norman last night, because I can't take any of that stuff either, because I'm an alcoholic. But I think I began to take them all and to die, and I had a moment of clarity, which I can't explain, because I hadn't had any clarity. Everything was like a burning, searing, white pain. And I had a moment of clarity, and it was a voice that just said to me, you're 29 years old, it's not supposed to be over. It's supposed to be beginning. And I had two phone numbers, and I ran and called one. One was to Alcoholics Anonymous, the other was to a treatment center, and I'd lost the one to AA, and I didn't know AA had existed, and I didn't know that's where it was to, but later my wife told me that. And the other was to a treatment center, and I just knew the truth. I said, if you don't take me, I'm going to die. And they said, it's Monday, if you can come here Wednesday, we'll take you. And I sat down on the floor where the phone was, and I just began to sob, and I looked at the counter, and there was a fifth of scotch sitting there with just a little bit out of it. And I knew I believe that God gives us, our loving, loving Father gives us something to start our sobriety with. And if you're kind of new, I wish you'd look and see what the unique and special thing is that He's given you. He may give you a belief in Him, which I didn't have when I came here. Or it may be someone, or a sponsor whom you immediately related to and admired. You know, it might be people who are praying for you. I don't know what it is, but I know He gives us all a lot of things, but He gives us one thing special. And the thing He gave me that was very special was the knowledge, as I looked at that fifth, that if I took one more drink, I would die. But more importantly, I knew that knowing that would never keep me from taking it. I didn't know the words, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. But that's what those words meant to me. And the first time I heard that read at a meeting, I said, I know that. I know that. Because that morning I knew that if I took one drink, I was going to die, and I knew that knowing that wouldn't keep me from taking it. And I went up and I tried to pour that out, and I knew that I'd never pour it out. And I knew if I took a drink, I'd die, and I knew that knowing that wouldn't keep me from taking it, and I knew I wouldn't pour it out. So I threw the bottle in the sink, and it broke. And I sincerely believed that if it had bounced, I wouldn't be here. But God wanted me here, so it broke. And I believe today, these 12 and a half years later, that that's more true now than it was in 1973. If I take one drink, I'm going to die. And knowing that will not keep me from taking it. That's my dilemma. And that's my blessing. Because that's the thing that binds me to you. That's the need that is the most tremendous blessing I've ever had in my life. Because that made me do what I needed to do to know you. You know, and I went off to that treatment center and I was terrified. All those old fears came back. The booze hadn't done anything to them, and it just buried them. And it exacerbated themselves. And I was afraid of everything. But you understood me. Remember the first meeting I went to, there was a man who stood at the door, and he shook my hand, and he shook it firmly, and he with both hands. And I like to shake hands that way, because I know what that meant to me. And he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, "You never have to drink again. If you stay with us, you never have to drink again." And I knew he was wrong. He didn't know I was different, and I didn't understand everything that you understood. And he knew that I was, he didn't know all that, but I knew it. And then the first person I met in Alcoholics Anonymous was an old lady, real old lady. She's about 10 days older than dirt. And she got me this half a cup of coffee and sat beside me and patted me on the leg. You ever? Oh my God. You know, the skin that used to be on my shoulder was on my leg, and everything was crawling around inside of me and everything, and this woman's patting me. And I knew what she did now. She kept me there. She kept me in one place so that maybe I could hear something. And halfway through the meeting in the Washington, D.C. area where I got sober, halfway through the meeting they stop and they have the announcements and take up the collection and everything, and then they finish the meeting. And halfway through the meeting she looked at me, and she, like this man who shook my hand, they looked dead in my eye, and her old face exploded into a loving smile, and she said, "Sonny, you never have to be alone again." And I began to cry, because I didn't know that what I was alone. I remember when my daughter Kimberly was not expected to live, and I used to sit in my office and look over at the nursery that she was in, the neonatal nursery that she was in. And I'd watch her struggling for breath. And I felt this horrible emptiness and this complete impotence to do anything. I didn't know that what I was alone. When I saw my wife walking around the hospital halls like a zombie, watching our 2-pound child struggle for every breath, knowing that she couldn't live, because all scientific knowledge to that day said she couldn't. God said she could, because 3 days before she was born, an experimental machine was brought to Georgetown University Medical Center. And the day before she was born, a man took a day off and put it together. And because I worked in that hospital, they risked using it on her. And today she's 15 years old and absolutely beautiful. But I didn't know that what I was alone. Sorry. No, I'm not. I didn't know that somewhere between the second and third drink, I lost any chance I ever had at finding me and you and God. I didn't know that. I didn't know that in the fifth chapter when it says all of our old ideas, I didn't know that meant me. I was loaded with old ideas. All I had were old ideas. I remember when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I desperately wanted what you had. You can't know how much I wanted it. But I had an old idea that if there was a God, the only reason that I think I believed in God was I was angry with him. And I had to be angry at something. And everything else had beaten me up so badly that I kept God to be angry at. That's the only contact I had with God at all, was rage, when I'd call him a despicable son of a bitch and all those things. And I thought that he hated me so much that if he found out how much I wanted what you had, he'd take it away. So my job was to try to con God. My job was to hang around you, desperately seeking you, acting like it didn't matter. And I'd show up trying to look casual. Do you know how many times you have to change clothes to get the casual look? I'd change clothes 4 or 5 times before I come to an AA meeting, just so I'd look casual. I'd be afraid sometimes. I got lost all the time when I was newly sober. I couldn't remember where I was supposed to go or what I was supposed to do, so I'd get lost a lot. So I'd leave for the meetings an hour early if they were 10 minutes away, and I'd sit across the street in my car because I didn't want to appear as though I was too anxious. And it made sense to me, because if my ideas were correct, which thank God they weren't, it was true, because all I'd ever wanted I'd lost. I'd wanted my military career, it was gone. I'd wanted my wife, she was gone. I wanted my children, they were gone. I wanted my career, it was gone. It seemed to me that everything I ever wanted was gone. I wanted to honor and love and respect my parents, and I couldn't. I cursed them. I wanted my brothers and sisters to admire me, and they looked on me with disdain. I wanted to be a kind and loving person, and I was just the opposite. So it seemed to me I was right, that if God found out I wanted something, he took it away. And of course that isn't true. But that's the way it was in the spiritually starved life of this alcoholic. I had another thing too. I thought I had to be right. I thought if I was wrong once, one time I was wrong, he'd say, get off the earth. You've had your chance. Get out of here. We knew you couldn't be trusted. I mean, wrong about anything. And I used to say to my wife, she'd say, you're never wrong. I said, that's not true. I'm frequently wrong. She said, no, you're never wrong. She said, if you get stuck, you put it on a shelf till you get more data. Then you drag it out and beat me over the head with it. She's absolutely correct. But she didn't know why. If I were wrong, I didn't belong. And I remember a man said to me one time, he said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, no, I'm not wrong. He said, you're wrong. He said, even if you're accurate, you're wrong. He said, I want you to borrow a lipstick from one of the girls in the program. That's all I was allowed to do with the girls in the program early. So I want you to borrow a lipstick from one of the girls in the program, and I want you to go home and write on your mirror, Keith, you're wrong. And I did everything I was told. So I borrowed some lipstick and I went home and I wrote, Keith, you're wrong. And I thought it was silly. I thought it was dumb. You know, the next morning, I'm still living in this little efficiency dive, and the next morning I woke up and all my friends were there. There was fear, and there was mistrust, and there was envy, and there was jealousy, and there was depression. And all they were all talking at once. They were all buying for my ear, and they'd say, you're never going to make it. You're insignificant. You're no good. They're going to find out you're a phony and they're going to throw you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was impotent, sexually impotent, which will wreak havoc with your sex life. And one voice was saying, you're going to be impotent the rest of your life. You're going to drink. All these voices were competing for me. And I went in the kitchen and I started to make coffee, and I was so depressed I began to cry. And I walked out of there and I walked in the bathroom and I looked on a mirror and there was that God-given message. It said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, thank God, if I'm right, I'm in a lot of trouble. And so all my old ideas have been wrong. And I believe I have a spiritual illness. And I believe that the proof that I'm on a spiritual mend is that I'm finding more and more and more old ideas that are wrong. My sponsor, Sandy, used to say to me, he'd say, let's play old ideas. And he challenged me to come up this week with an old idea. And boy, it's fun to look around through your life, sort of the rubbish and the refuge that's just sort of lying around, saying, hey, there's an old idea. You know, he gave me an old idea one time. It was when Hubert Humphrey was dying of cancer. We were sitting out in Washington Circle one day, Sandy and I, eating lunch. And he said, and feeding pigeons, and he said, birds, not new people in the program. And he said, you know, I was new. I hated that term. I hated the term newcomer. I used to say to my sponsor, I said, when am I no longer a newcomer? He said, when you stop getting mad every time somebody says newcomer. You know? We're out there feeding the pigeons. And he said to me, he said, what would you do if you found you were dying of cancer? And I said, well, that's easy. I'd sell my house. I'd put some of the money away for the children. And I'd travel and I'd go to different AA meetings and everything. He said, you know what Hubert Humphrey did? And I said, no. He said, this morning he showed up for work. And he said, you know, he's so frail, he had to be helped up the steps to the Senate building. He said, but I guess he figures that God's will for him is to be a senator. I thought, you know, that's right. That every day I'm dying. That's the nature of being alive. And when I begin to know the date, nothing changes. God's will is for me to live that day sober, doing what he put me here to do. But that's the kind of games we used to play, old ideas. I want to share one more with you. I had an idea. Maybe somebody out there has this idea. The idea is that for every problem, there's one solution. I had that idea, and I remember I had a problem. It was a terrible problem. And there were a few old-timers who I trusted to have the solution. And one guy's name was Don. Great guy. He's a retired Army general. And he used to puff on his cigar, and he used to say, I always ask myself, what's that got to do with drinking whiskey? And he tied everything in to not drinking, which I thought was a novel approach in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I took him this problem. And he said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh my God. Because if you don't get the answer to your problem, you're going to drink. I don't know where I heard that, but that was my idea. And so I said, what do I do? He said, well, why don't you go downtown and ask so-and-so? So he gave me the name of this guy down at the Metropolis Club. So I beat it down there. I mean, this is an emergency. I got about 2 hours to live. And so I hunt this guy up, and he's out on the 12-step call. And finally, he came back. I said, I got to talk to you. I said, I got this problem. And I said, hey, he said, we're going to have a meeting now. I said, I don't have time. He said, look, after the meeting, we'll talk. So I sat there during the whole meeting and thought about my problem. And when the meeting was over, I told him my problem. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, boy. He said, I don't know. He said, neat old black guy with white hair, neat guy. He said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, no. He said, what I'd suggest is don't drink even if your ass falls off. Now, I remember driving home and I said, that is the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. Because that's the answer here. You know, this isn't for problems. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't for problems. Alcoholics Anonymous is a solution for living. A good spiritual existence takes care of problems. It doesn't bar problems. It doesn't guarantee we don't have problems. But it takes care of problems. That's what this thing is for. This whole deal is about not drinking so we can work the steps so we can not drink. It's real simple. It's real, real simple. And I'm glad it's simple because I'm a complicated person and I need a real simple solution. You know, I didn't get to talk nearly as much about God as I wanted to, and my time's just about up. But I want to talk a little bit about God. And the reason talking about God is important for me is when the big book says that we talk about how we found God. That's what we do here. And the other thing is because God, for me, is a jewel of unspeakable price. Because it was something that couldn't exist. You know, like being on Jekyll Island with 500 sober people, playing golf with new friends like Tom and Ed, and renewing acquaintances with old friends like Rose and Bob and Juanita and Sue and Chet from Atlanta. You know, those are all jewels of unspeakable price. You're a jewel of unspeakable price. Because none of you were ever supposed to happen to somebody who was so close to death from alcoholism, who was absolutely spiritually bankrupt, absolutely spiritually. A person who had done everything he swore he'd never do, and absolutely and totally loathed himself and everything he stood for. That's what makes you so incredible in my life. You've always been there. The first meeting I ever went to was a second step meeting. And it told me that I needed to find something outside of myself that would restore me to sanity. And I remembered alcohol. And alcohol did that for me for a while. It took this 113-pound, 5-foot-1-inch, terrified child and transformed him into a 6-foot-2-inch, giant of a man. Yeah. It worked. And then it ended up robbing me of everything that there ever was, so that I was even sicker than I had begun. It took all the roots of spiritual illness and exacerbated everything. And I want to tell you about my impotence. I don't know, I'm supposed to do that, I think. I was sexually impotent when I came to this program, and it was a big problem for me. And if anybody's kind of new and having the same problem, I want to talk about this for a minute. You know, it scared me to death, and I wasn't talking to anybody about it because I was 29 years old and I was trying to stick my chest out a lot and look cool, you know, because I didn't know what a real man was, so I had to try like hell to be one. And finally, I got up the courage, or that I was desperate enough to go and talk to somebody about this. I was sober about 3 months, so I went to an old-timer. You got to watch old-timers, guys as old as Bob, you know, sober as long as him, because their minds get funny after, I don't know whether it's, I think it's the 15th year, their minds starts to get funny. And they lose track of time, and they lose track of priorities. I went to this old guy, and I said to him, I hemmed and hawed for 45 minutes, and finally I said, I'm impotent, and he laughed. You know, and I said, there's not a thing amusing about this. And he said, look, he said, it happens to all of us. There are many of us. He said, don't worry about it. It'll be all right. I said, how long? He said, a couple years. I said, a couple years? You know, I secretly wasn't even going to live a couple years. And so I went to somebody who was newer in a program and more in touch with reality and had a bigger ego problem. And I said, how long? And they said, 6 months to a year. I said, I'll talk to you about this thing. And finally, I went to my sponsor. I made a mistake of needing my sponsor to think that I was good so that he'd continue to sponsor me. Because I was sure that if he ever knew who I was, he wouldn't want to sponsor me. He would not want to have his name linked with mine. That's a horrible way to feel, but that's the way I felt about myself. And I went to him, and finally, sponsors are magnificent creatures. I went to him, and his name was Dan, my first sponsor. And I said, Dan, I got this problem, and I told him about it. He looked at me, and he patted me on the arm. He said, you're going to be all right. He said, you know, your problem is perspective. And I said, what do you mean? He said, every time we have a discussion meeting, whatever the problem we discuss, you have it, right? I said, yeah, Dan. I said, I got them all. He said, that's right. He said, you got a lot of problems. He said, being impotent is just one of them, right? I said, that's right. And he said, okay, let's get some perspective on this. He said, which problem do you have do you think is going to be more fun to work on than that one? And I said, you know, I can't think of a problem that's going to be more fun to work on now. See, that's what sponsors do. They put a smile on tragedy. You know? But anyway, honestly, it is a spiritual program. And I just want to report the therapy's going well. But, you know, this search for mine, this search for God, and I needed to find you first. Because I was too angry with God. And I was too angry with religious people. I made a discovery a couple years ago. I always said, I think the phrase I've heard quoted more often in AA than any other is, I just don't like organized religion. Well, I never met an alcoholic who liked organized anything, but you know, I figured it out. My problem wasn't organized religion. My problem was I wasn't the Pope. If I had been a Pope, I'd have loved organized religion. You know? My problem was me. You know, I wanted you all to treat me based on my intentions, and I wanted to judge you all on your actions. And so what I did was I judged spiritual people, I judged religious people, because I was afraid of you. And I judged you harshly. I judged you very harshly. So I had to put you on my 8-step list. You know, I judged clergy people very, very harshly. So I had to put clergymen on my 8-step list. And you know, I went and talked to God about this. I was sober about 4 or 5 years. And I went and had a long talk with God about how I felt about him and how I misunderstood that it wasn't him who was doing this to me. It was me and my disease that was doing this to me. And he was waiting there the whole time with his arms open just for me. And I told him, I said, you know, I really feel foolish, you know, getting this so screwed up. And he said, I understand, and I love you. I've always loved you. And I said, geez, that's nice. And then I knew I had to go, and I had to get right with organized religion. I had to be free to go to church. And for so long, I was not free to go to church. And so what I did was I went down to a retreat house in Faulkner, Maryland, and I had prayed about this, and I asked God to give me guidance in this, as I did with all my 9 steps. And I talked to my sponsor about it. And I went down there, and there happened to be a young theologian there. I had a degree in theology. And there happened to be a young theologian, a hot shot, who would understand the deep significance of this magnificent thing I was doing. And I couldn't find him. He was never in his room when I went to talk to him. But in the next room was this old priest who just sat in his rocking chair with his blanket around his shoulder, reading his Bible. And being the incredible intellect and intuitive genius I am, after about 3 hours, it suddenly dawned on me that God somehow wanted me to talk to this man and not to this young, hotshot theologian who would understand the deep significance of this magnificently humble act I was about to perform. And I went in and I sat down in the rocking chair opposite this man, and I began to tell him about me and about alcoholism. I began to tell him how I defied God and how I defied religious people, how I never missed an opportunity to put them down and to say something blasphemous and obscene. And I went through all of it. And I told him what it was like being drunk, what it was like abusing my wife and abusing my children, leaving an infant in a crib to go get a bottle. I told him all these things. And I was about halfway through, and he put his Bible down, and he got up, and he hugged me, and he began to cry. And he said, "For God's sake, son, stop." He said, "Please, it's me who should make amends to you." He said, "I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, "Too often during those 50 years, I got comfortable with the people who liked me and agreed with me. And I forgot that my master told me to leave the 99 that I was comfortable with and to find you." And he said, "I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone." An amazing thing happened to me in that ninth step. Two of us began to get healed. And that's why this is a WE program. You know, a few years ago, I was sitting on a balcony in a little apartment in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I was reading from the Big Book and also the Big Book. And as you may have noticed, I cry rather easily. I think I'm a sensitive Irish alcoholic who feels tremendously deep gratitude. And I began to cry, and I just sort of shouted out, you know, "Why me, God?" And I was reminded, when I was in the treatment center, I called my poor battered ex-wife. And I said to her, I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" And she said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And there I was, sitting on that balcony, overwhelmed with the incredible gratitude of the gifts that God had given me. I had come to believe that he was big enough to sacrifice his son for me. I had come to realize that you were his representative in my life. And he sent you to me because you had skin on and you had eyes that I could look into and could look into mine. And I was too spiritually ill to believe in anything that didn't have skin on it. And I just shouted out, screamed out, "Why me, God? Why me, Father?" And he said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And that's the magnificence of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the reason that I'm privileged and blessed to be here. That's the reason no price was too great. Because that's the greatest discovery in the world. For an alcoholic who never belonged anywhere, the good news is just too good to be true. I want to thank you so very much for the privilege and the honor of coming here and sharing with you. Please travel carefully. I hope that God goes with you as we continue to spread the grace that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.